Hey, welcome back to the podcast. This is show number 102, and this week's guest is Andrew Keetle, and Andrew comes to talk to us about his wonderful 7x17 camera and his 4x5 pinhole work. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the podcast. This is show 102, Andrew. Andrew Bartram.
Mm-hmm.
Hello, Andrew Bartram.
Hello, Corey. You all right?
Yeah, I'm doing good. We have two Andrews on the show, this show, so we're going to have to make sure that we are specifically directing our statements to which Andrew you want it to be, you know? it's going to be interesting. But cool. I said that, so I'll go ahead and introduce Andrew. This week's guest is Andrew Keetle. Hello, Andrew.
Hi.
Yeah, how's it going, Andrew Bartram?
Andrew B and Andrew K.
There you go.
It's okay. It's good. I'm getting a lot of time in the dark room, and cool. which is nice, you know.
Yeah,
and
that's good.
Eventually, when lockdown is eased, I'll get out and make some more negatives. But I'm not in any great hurry. Enjoying the printing.
Yeah, that's cool.
I've just been doing some more lith prints because I've been part of this box camera project all year. It started last February, so it's been pretty good for lockdown. We use it. Well, I don't think you have to use a different camera every month because I haven't got 12 anyway, but I've got about 6 or 7 box cameras. So some of them I've used twice.
And
my favorite one is that Brownie Hawkeye flash with a flipped lens. So that gives me a focal length of about 14 inches. And it's just brilliant for portraits. So I just stick the camera in front of someone's face.
Cool.
And I just seem to get the eyes nailed and the rest of it goes weird, you know.
Who have you been doing that with?
Well, I was doing it with Julie. We went for a walk.
Meant like the box camera of Alex.
Oh, no, that was Neil Piper's project.
Yeah.
So each month, I think I've missed 1 month out because during lockdown it became such a chore to try and find things to photograph, you know. I tried everything in the garden and I couldn't be bothered to try and do still lives and stuff because I just can't be bothered. So I thought for the last one I'd take out the Hawkeye again and I did some portraits of Julie with a mask on and a hood up. So that looks quite dramatic. So you got just the eyes really and then the mask below it, you know.
Yeah.
And I did some gravestones and I've just been making some lith prints and they're looking okay. So
if you don't know, so if any listeners aren't sure about Neil Piper, you should check him out because he's a good dude. He's got a lot of cool stuff.
And the co-host of Sutton Whitewash podcast.
That's right. Yeah.
So I think, I don't know what he's going to do. I don't know whether he's been, all the images of, he's been posting them on a blog and I think there's going to be a zine because there has to be a zine, doesn't there? You know?
Yeah.
At some point.
Cool.
But yeah, no pinhole photography for me, really. Just darkroom stuff.
Yeah. Cool.
How about you? What's the weather like in North Carolina?
Oh, rainy and cold and dreary and blah. I got some film about a week ago. I got a roll of it in my little reality and just been kind of using it here and there, you know? So, yeah.
What you been up to then, Andrew? You've been Andrew K.?
Well, with the weather, which has been so wet, I haven't been out much. Obviously, we're in lockdown as well, but the local walks are just the like swimming pools. So I've been inside printing, trying to master long way from cyanotypes and calotypes.
You can explain all that to us in a minute.
Yeah.
I think I took my little Hawkeye over to the kiddies playground, but I always feel a bit weird going over the kiddies playground with a camera, don't you? You know,
yes.
So I have to look first, make sure there's no small children in before I go wandering around.
Yeah, awkward.
And so many people take pictures in empty playgrounds as a sort of metaphor for, you know, disaster, apocalypse, and lockdown, and you know, not being able to go outside. Swings seem very popular.
Mm.
But anyway, you know.
Waiting line for those. Huh?
I love a cliche.
Yeah. You're a walking cliche, Andrew.
I know. Yeah. So whereabouts in the country are you based, Andrew?
I'm in Suffolk, so East Anglia. Oh, yeah. I'm just outside Ipswich.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so have you seen The Dig yet?
No.
Yes. Yeah, I watched that with the family the night it came out on Netflix.
You don't sound like a Suffolk boy, I have to say.
No, I'm not originally from Suffolk. I have been here for many, many years, but I have tried to not gain the Suffolk accent. It's a little rural.
I stayed in Ipswich for several stretches of my time when I was at Sizewell Power Station doing my training. And there was a street called Foundation Street. I don't know if you know it.
Yep.
Now, there was two or three little terraced houses left. The rest of them had been knocked down for car parks. And one of those houses was owned by an old lady and her husband. And I stayed there off and on.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
Foundation.
So, yeah, that's behind the co-op.
I can't remember. She had a really interesting guest book because she must be somewhere near the theatre, or is it Theatre Royal or whatever somewhere?
The Regent.
Well, whatever the theatre is, she must be somewhere near it because she had a guest book. She had a young Shirley Bassey. She was showing me autographs of all these sort of stars of stage and screen who.
Yep.
I guess before they became properly famous, they just went to Ipswich.
So, casting aspersions about the glamour of Ipswich there.
Well,
not wrongly.
I do know it, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I thought The Dig was great, though. You know the film we're talking about, Corey?
I do not.
It's on Netflix.
Okay.
But just been released with Voldemort is in the lead, you know, Mr. Fiennes. What's his first name? But it's about the Sutton Hoo Anglo-Saxon burial ship that they dug up in Suffolk back in just before World War II.
Oh, wow.
So, I've looked it up. Could enjoy it. No pinhole photography, but there's a guy with a Rolleiflex.
Oh, God. Taking pictures. Rolleiflexes.
So tell us a little bit about yourself. Tell us a little bit about yourself, Andrew. I know about your pictures and your website and stuff, but what do you do in the daytime?
Okay, well, not a lot at the minute because of lockdown and other stuff. So historically, I'm a software developer. I've done that since I left school many, many, many decades ago. So I've always been interested in photography.
Because you're a software developer?
No, well, as an escape, really.
Yeah, I don't blame you. Yeah.
You spend all day in front of one or two big screens, not talking to people. Yeah. So I then liked to go in the dark room and not talk to people.
Yes.
But it was while software developing is interesting and fun, and you get to create lots of things, you don't actually get to hold anything. There's no physical thing that you produce, and I'm not an artist. I can't paint, can't draw. So photography was kind of the only way that you could come up with some tangible thing that you could hold and say, I made that from start to finish kind of thing. So I've done software developing, and then the company I was working for was a startup which exited. So there was an opportunity to take some time off. And I started doing some photography and video work for local companies for promotional social media stuff. But then obviously the world changed. So that hasn't been happening for the last nearly a year. So I've kind of took the opportunity to pick up my first photography stuff.
Did you have a background in shooting videos then? I mean, it's if you're doing it for a living, you must. Did you have a background in shooting videos?
No, it's something. So one of my other pastimes is cycling, and competitive cycling. So I race for a local bike shop. So all kinds, so cyclocross, road races, time trials, mountain biking. And I would just take along, I've got a a digital Panasonic GH5, which can take photos and do videos. So I would go and record some of the other races at the cyclocross and edit videos and publish those for people to amuse themselves at looking at how ridiculous they are whilst enjoying themselves in the mud. Mm-hmm. So I kind of took the opportunity of the career break to try and do that for some social media stuff. So I did a couple of videos. Also did, interestingly, with a 360 degree camera, which enables you to sort of do the scene composing after the fact, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
So look, we were doing people running or riding bikes and stuff, and so you place the camera in interesting positions, and then you edit it afterwards to get the different compositions and stuff. So that was going okay, but that's petered out. Obviously now businesses are struggling with pandemic and Brexit and stuff, so I might have to unretire from software development and get a job doing that soon.
Mm. So film photography then, is that something that's always been with you, or have you sort of lurched towards it in recent times?
No, so I did have a darkroom. I dispensed with it, I don't know, about 12 years ago, when the family popped up. It was just a converted bedroom. I had a De Vere 5x4 and larger. Nice.
Did you keep it?
Yeah.
Oh, you should have done.
No. No, I did manage to sell it. I sometimes sit and think about the equipment I had and I now no longer have, and especially the price of it now. You think, it's bonkers. I did quite a lot of film photography, purely as an amateur, purely as a distraction from software development. And lith printing was the thing I loved most. I just spent many evenings and nights just trying to print something nice with lith, because it's hit and miss and you can't recreate what you've already printed, but it's kind of magical, and that gives you that real sense of actually having made something. So the family came along and we haven't got a very big house and we needed the bedrooms, so it all went, and I sold virtually everything apart from the unsellable, which was my 7x17 ultra large format camera.
I saw that. I've seen you talk about that online, so I know it's not lensless, but I was gonna we have to talk about your 7x17 camera. you could always stick a picture.
Yeah.
I thought that must be something you had kind of bought recently. I didn't realize you'd had it all that time.
No, over the summer, last summer, I took the advantage of unmothballing it all. It kind of been sitting there like, like a ghost, like a shadow, like something haunting me. So it was a chronic case of gas gear acquisition syndrome. So I went through all the stages of the film sizes and formats, from 35mm to medium format to large format and panoramic and all that kind of stuff. And somehow I came across ultra large format panoramic. A guy called Richard Ritter in America makes these cameras. Super talented camera maker. We were dual income, no kids at that point, so disposable money. And so... somehow I talked myself into it.
Talked your missus into it as well. You did well there.
She's hugely tolerant. I have no idea why or how, but yes.
To get this straight for pinhole photographers, we're talking about, when we say 7x17, we're talking about inches, not centimetres, aren't we?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, we are. And it's bonkers. It's huge. So I'd shot 4x5. I'd shot 8 by 10. I had a Deardorff. And so I was used to using sheet film, used to handling it in the dark room, used to printing it. But 7 by 17 is just bonkers. Literally, just thinking about it, you think, why? But the reason why is because you can contact print it with alternative processes. It's a beautiful panoramic format. And if you see some nice images, it's like, yeah, that's it. That's the pinnacle. Obviously, my skills weren't good enough. So I tried and failed to create some images. And when the family came along, it was like, this is a good excuse just to put it aside and ignore it. That happened. And then pandemic happened, so I got it all out and fired it up again, which led to Pinhole in cool. a roundabout way, because I needed to get back into the swing of handling sheet film, developing it, printing it, and doing it in a less costly way than messing up 7x17 film. So, I mean, the reason why I went, because I only have one pinhole camera. I have a Harman Titan 4x5.
That's a good one.
It's fantastic. I love it. It's really good. And the images you get out of it are so sharp for a pinhole. I kind of don't regard it as a pinhole. They don't look like typical pinhole images, and I'm not quite sure why that is. I haven't worked that out. I've really enjoyed it, and I think I probably shoot more pinhole than I do 7x17 at the minute, for various reasons, I suppose. Cost, logistics. It's much easier to carry.
It looks like it is. That looks like a humongous camera.
It is. I bought it, I don't know, 12, 13 years ago. So it was new then, but it's got carbon fiber rail, so it's not that heavy.
Right.
The film holders are not that light, but they're not that heavy. But by the time you've got that, and I've only have one workable lens, which is a 355mm G Claron. By the time you've got all that, there's a lot of kit, and it's all of it together is quite heavy, but it's just so cumbersome. I went for a walk with it, I don't know, 4 mile walk around the local area during a lockdown, and I came back and I was just shattered. Whereas you can take the pinhole out and you can take, you know, 5 or 10 film holders with you, and it's nothing. So it's much more convenient.
Yeah. What do you do? What do you like to shoot film wise?
I only really shoot Ilford, because that's all I have ever shot, I suppose. And one of the other reasons is because I feel I ought to support them, because they still do ultra large format and odd size runs once a year.
Mm-hmm.
So I can still get film from my 7x17. So I kind of feel beholden to buy their other film. I mean, it's great. It's not cheap, but you know, it's super reliable. Unless we get into the discussion about 120, but I don't shoot that. So.
Well, we touched on that last show about the 120 problems.
Yeah.
It's not something I've experienced yet. I do wonder if some of it's down to moisture condensation. I think that's what Ilford hint at, but I think folks think it's more than that, so I don't really know.
Yeah, it's a worry, and I think the fact that they haven't got a handle on it probably leads to the fact that it's more a user issue than a manufacturing issue. I'm thinking.
No,
I don't know. That's just
you'd think with all their experience. So with all their experience, they've got to know how to make film, haven't they?
Really? Well, there's only so many places that they can check where something would be going wrong, you know. So eventually, if they get that out of the equation, something else, you know. I don't know. Yeah. I have a roll of that in. I'm shooting a roll of that, the Pan 50 right now. So I'll find out. And
I think if you've had it in the fridge, just make sure you let it.
Well, that's what I did this time. I didn't put it in there. I just kept it in my bookcase in my bedroom, you know. Yeah, because it's only 6 rolls, 3 of the FP4 and 3 of the Pan 50. So I mean, I'll use it.
I think if you're if you want to stockpile film for the apocalypse, then you might want to put it in the fridge. I mean, mine's in the fridge, but I have to say, I get loads of grief from Julie, you know, especially around Christmas time when we're looking to put food in there. We have two fridges, and so I take over pretty much one of them. But she, you know, I've just put some shelves up in my office. I'm thinking of just storing my film on the shelf in here, really, to be honest, because I don't really think it needs to be refrigerated.
Yeah, it swings and roundabouts. I think maybe an issue is temperature fluctuations. Mm. So if it keeps going hot and cold, it's a bit like wine, I think. So interestingly, so when I was doing my 7x17 originally, I bought film when I could buy it. So I do have a reasonable stash of film, which has never been in a fridge. It's in my bedroom in a box wrapped in blankets. Just to try and keep it at a constant low-ish temperature. I do have some developing issues with the 7x17, but that's because I'm using a rotary tank that has some ridges and gaps in it, which causes
which
density
tank are you
issues.
Using? You're not using tray developing with it?
I don't have a dark room.
Oh, yeah,
that's
right.
I don't have a space to. I need to try and get a workshop or a shed or something that I can create some space. So for pinhole and for 7x17, I load my film holders in a Harrison Dark tent on the dining room table, and I develop in Jobo tanks or a Patterson tank.
Which Jobo ones do you use for the big stuff, Andrew?
So it's I think it's a 2850. Uh-huh. So it's a print tank for up to like 20x16, I suppose. But it does have some ribs. So you can put two sheets in. It has some ribs that keep the film in place, but there are also some gaps in it. And because of the quality of developer you can put in, and because I think the film I have is like 10 years expired, I get density issues, I get streaks.
I've got the 2840 drum, which came with my my gifted CPE2 processor. I think the 2840 is just a little bit smaller, but if you put a bigger base on, it becomes probably the next size up, doesn't it? Because this one, the one I'm staring at, can hold one sheet of 12x16. So I need to be slightly bigger. Yeah. I'm thinking of using this for RA4 printing later in the summer. You know, I want to do some colour printing. I've been reading up on it. And
well, I think the bigger tanks are primarily designed for printing paper. You can. There were some others that had film inserts, but they're not made, and you can't get hold of them.
I use. Carry on.
No, well, interestingly, I had some FP4 and some 100 speed black and white Shanghai, which didn't show those issues. So I think it's a combination with the 10-year-old expired HP5, which is faster. And it might be in a worse condition. I've got a couple of boxes.
If you're processing those, your expired films in your drum, are you pre-wetting the film or not? Because people say that makes a difference, don't they?
Yes, I do. I mean, Ilford don't recommend
it. They don't,
it,
not in rotary, do they?
Yeah, but so the tank doesn't always seal. Mm-hmm. So you put some liquid in and then tip it up and it starts leaking everywhere, so I pre-wet so that I know that the tank is sealed, because otherwise you're just done at that point. There's a few things to sort out, which has kind of put a halt on the 7x17 stuff at the minute, but I'm enjoying the pinhole. So
and so what are you using to develop your 4x5 pinholes? You're using a Jobo for that, are you, or?
No, I use a Patterson and the Mod 54 insert. Yep. And also I have an old Patterson Orbital.
Yep.
So you can do four sheets in that, and that works reasonably well with, you know, next to no volume of chemicals.
So that's the Patson orbital is the flat thing that sort of rocks around, isn't it? And the Stearman brought out a 8x10 similar thing, didn't he, last year or the year before, which can be divided into four as well, I think. I just bought, I sold my mod, not because I didn't like it, but I needed to, because I've become obsessed with Jobo's stuff, you know. I bought a, bought a 4x5 reel to go inside my 20, whatever it is, the Jobo tank I use for 120. It's not the 25 series, it's the other one, the smaller one.
The 1500.
That's it, yeah, I was struggling to think what it was. So I've got a 1540, so it's 1530 and a 1510 or something.
How do you find loading that?
Well, I haven't actually used it yet, so I'm okay with the spirals, the 120 and 35 mil. I quite like those. And I bought the insert from 20th Century Camera from Jeff Perry, and he sells his 6-sheet spiral 3D printed spiral, which fits inside either a litre Patson tank, so like yours, or it'll fit inside a 1540. So that's the 1530 extension of 1510 base.
And you can still do that rotary. Yes.
Yeah. What you'd have to do for the Jobo is it comes with two little O-rings that you put either side of it, and it just holds it tight on the spiral because it's it's a flush interference fit for the Patson, but for the Jobo, if you don't put the O-rings on, it won't rotate because it'll just sit, it doesn't fit tightly on the spigot on the spindle inside. So it's very clever. And just with two, I think about 20 mil soft nitrile O-rings that he sends you, it clamps the thing together.
I'll be interested to hear how you get on with that, because that's another option for the 7x17.
Yeah.
He will custom make his spiral insert for the larger tanks.
I've used his,
which might remove the issue.
It might do, yeah. I've used his spiral. I had his previous version for 4x5, but that his previous version didn't fit the Jobo, you see, so I sold that as well to some bloke in Norway, I think. And I always got on well with that. I could load it easily in the dark, you know. So that was okay. So I knew I could load the 20th Century Camera one. When I realised it would fit the Jobo, so I bought it earlier, just after Christmas, but I've not shot any large format films since then. So I was using the Jobo to back... Once I got the Jobo, I was using it to back process about 12 rolls of colour film that I had. And I've been... delighted with the consistency of colour that I've been getting. I'm not great at colour treatment, you know, colour processing on Photoshop and stuff, but I've been delighted how the colours have been coming out using the Jobo. So
cool.
I'm a big fan. But I think it would work well for your 7x17. Yeah.
Yes, that might have to be an avenue I go down. Because even if I develop it in trays, you have to use 16x20 trays, which is a lot of space.
Yeah.
I did try it when I had a dark room, but I didn't get on with it very well. But
Have you got any space to rebuild a dark room somewhere, like in a garage or somewhere like I do?
We have a very large shed, but unfortunately it's as old as the house, so it's over 100 years old. So it's about to fall down. So it's not weather tight. So that needs
to light tight.
Definitely light tight. So that needs to come down, and we need to replace it. And then hopefully I can create some space in there. I don't need a lot. I don't have plans to get an enlarger and get back into that. The alternative printing is satisfying that need for now. So I don't think I'd need a lot of space.
Yeah, so tell us about that. I've been seeing some beautiful work you've been posting on with cyanotypes and calotypes, and I guess it's with your situation, I guess, using the pinhole camera. I know you've been using that to make some negatives, but I know you've been making digital negatives as well, so that's all standard. I've toyed with the idea of making digital negatives, but it all sounds far too complicated.
It is rather. It's a whole rabbit hole. It's a very deep rabbit hole. So the original plan, just taking one step backwards, the original plan with the 7x17 was to produce these stunning panoramic platinum palladium contact prints. That was kind of how I sold it to myself. Mm-hmm. So at the point I sold it all and mothballed it all, I had everything to do that. And I had started learning how to do platinum palladium prints. So that all got stored under the bed in the attic, and that's been resurrected. So I got everything out, started developing film and starting doing prints, and then remembered why I put it all away. So I thought I need to go back to basics. So hence the pinhole, hence doing it as 4x5, because although they're little, they are printable. You can print them as contact prints. 5x7 would be better, but you know, that's not reasonable. So the whole point of the pinhole was just to get back into developing, shooting, printing. I started back doing the platinum palladium, but it's very expensive and very time consuming. So I thought, well, let's make this even more simpler. And kind of the simplest alternative printing is cyanotypes. It's, you know, it's easy to coat. The chemicals aren't terribly dangerous. And you know, they're easy to develop. There's no nasty chemicals for developing. It's just washing. And then you can tone them to certain degrees. So that was kind of the step into getting back into comfortable with doing those things. And the Cali type is a process. It's another process similar to cyanotypes and platinum palladium. There are a few more steps involved, but you can end up with results that are virtually indistinguishable from platinum palladium. But it is considerably cheaper, which allows you to iterate and learn stuff.
Talk us through calotype a little bit, because I think a lot of listeners will be familiar with cyanotypes, because that's just two chemicals. Yep. That's potassium ferricyanide and ferric ox. What is it?
So
two things mixed together, isn't it, for cyanotype?
Yeah. So, well, for the cyanotype, I is it Wet Plate Supplies?
Yes, down the road from me.
Yeah. So they do a pre-mixed a micware solution, is just one. Yeah. Which is a re-engineered cyanotype solution, which is supposed to, I've not printed the old way, but gives you more contrast, doesn't wash out off the paper so easily, and has a much longer shelf life. So it's pre-mixed, and you just keep it dark, and then you coat your paper and you use it. So that's been a godsend, because you've just got one solution, you just coat your paper. And
I use Kevin mixes up my Pyrocat HD, which a lot of people use at 2+2+100 for platinum work, I think, or 1+2. Yep. I know people like Steve Segersby and Matt Marash do. But I'd missed the fact that he did a pre-mixed cyanotype. I might have to give that a go.
And it's £10 for 100 mil. Or something like that.
And did you start off? I know we haven't got to calotypes yet, but did you start off using just original negatives, or how?
Yes. So it's been a really interesting exercise for me. So even though you would think, having had 7x17, I know what I'm doing. Unfortunately, not really. I have some idea, and I've read all the books, but my technique is rather sloppy. So exposure-wise and development-wise, you know, everyone talks about expose for zone 3 and work out the exposure range, and that determines how long you develop it for. I'm kind of a little loose around that. Mm-hmm. And so if you scan electronically and print electronically, it doesn't really matter most of the time, because you can recover most things, unless it's terribly underexposed. you've got so much flexibility, you don't really learn much. But when you start trying to print your negatives, you kind of understand about how much underexposed you've got, or how overdeveloped you are, or underdeveloped. And so the contrast range and how you try and print them. So the different processes require different kind of densities and contrast ranges. And so when you go and try and print those, you kind of join the dots about what all those things are and what you need to do differently. So as an example, so some of my learnings from that is, originally I was using a light meter on my phone. I can't remember which one, for the pinholes, and it was kind of giving me some numbers, and it compensates for reciprocity. Mm-hmm. Is that how you say mm-hmm. it? Yep. But sometimes, obviously, if you had bright skies and stuff, your shadows were underexposed. So trying to then print those as cyanotypes or calotypes, you just can't print them. So with my pinhole, it kind of, it's interesting to listen to your previous number of your previous episodes about people making their own pinholes and shoving a piece of film or a piece of paper and then just leave it and come back and being really loose about stuff. And I'm thinking, oh my God, I'm using a spot meter to try and work out what my shadows are going to be for my pinhole exposures. Mm-hmm. because I'm trying to print them as cyanotypes or calotypes. Because if you haven't done that, then you just end up with really dark images with no contrast. So it's interesting. So I think one of the pictures you put up when you said you were doing this podcast was one of a groin in Felix mm-hmm. Day as a calotype, yeah. which is really dark. And that's a contact print from up of a 4x5 pinhole that is underexposed and not developed long enough for a calotype. But it actually prints up quite nicely like that, because it looks like it's a night scene, because it's a long exposure anyway, because I shot it with a red filter. So the C's quite flat. And so it actually works, but it's nothing like what it was shot in, midday in nearly bright sunshine. but because of the way it was developed and exposed, it's like that. So
you've got a couple of versions of that, and you've got the dark, very heavily dark yep. brown with no shadow details, and you've got the bluey coloured one. Is that a cyanotype, the blue one?
Sorry, I lost you there.
You've got the very dark blue brown one.
Yep.
And then you've got a bluish one. I was looking on your Instagram feed, the bluish yep. one at the top.
Yep.
That's cyanotype, is it?
With the
yes. Yeah, yeah. So the cyanotype, I don't know whether I got the terms right. Cyanotypes require less contrast. Is that right? Presumably. So they'll print brighter. So with all my printing, I'm trying to print with a reasonable black or a reasonable dark tone. And then that obviously determines where your high, because with these processes, it's very difficult to control the contrast in. So with cyanotypes, you can't very easily unless you change the original solution. And with calotypes, you can a bit in the developer. But so the cyanotype looks brighter, I think, because cyanotypes require less contrast than calotypes. So the blue one is obviously a straight cyanotype. And then further down, there's a palladium toned calotype, and I think there's also the orangier one is a selenium toned. But as you can see, there's very little detail in the foreground. Yeah. That's because there's not enough contrast in the negative.
Most of these things, I think, need good shadow detail, don't they? That's the good
yeah.
starting point.
Because otherwise, it's. Yeah, if there's no separation there, then it's just mush. But if you scan that, so a little bit further down in my Instagram feed, there's a direct film scan and a normal digital processing, so you can see the highlights in the shingle.
So
and so
yeah. Carry on, sorry.
Yeah, so if you then want to print, if you want to make a digital negative, you have got that information there to change by using the curves that you require for producing digital negatives, which is which are different for each of the processes. You can then print that as more as you intend, rather than just with a straight film negative.
So if you start off with a fairly decent film,
but that's the rabbit hole that you disappear down, is to try and create the curves that are required for each process and to make that reproducible, which is what I'm kind of struggling with at the minute.
Have you reached out to Stephen Segsby?
No, I've not heard that name.
Look him up on Twitter. Steve Segs, I think, is. Message me and I'll give you his details. Steve does a lot of printing, a lot of platinum palladium printing, and I know he spent a lot of time working out digital curves, you know, curves and profiles for this, that, and the other.
Yep.
So I don't know what he's done with color types. I think he might have played with color types in the earlier days, but he's on episode 4, 5, or 6 of the large format photography podcast as well.
There are lots of resources about how to do it, and lots of it's. I didn't want to have to do it. I wanted to try and avoid it, but because my technique is too sloppy, you can't. If you want to end up printing your stuff, there are lots of discussions about what printers to use, what inks to use, what software to use, and whether you need a rip or whether you don't. What I've used is a system called Easy Digital Negatives, which is a bit of a mis-selling because it's not, but it's probably the easiest process for creating a digital negative by a guy called Peter Mahar. It's M-R-H-A-R. And he has a reasonably simple system where you print off some test charts, you print them, and he gives you some suggestions about changing the ink densities and how to get your whites white and what exposure times and stuff. And then you scan or take a photo of your printed test chart after you've toned it, fixed it, and whatever, and dried it. And then it works online. You don't have to download any software. We'll analyze that test chart and produce you a curve, and you can then apply that. And it works pretty much. I've got I'd say works pretty much. It works really well. There is some tweaking that you might need to do, but one of the issues I'm having, and I don't think it's to do with the process, is. The first, the image at the top of my Instagram feed, which is the one I call I Hate My Brain, I can't print that with the digital negative without seeing too much grain and or what look like inkjet artifacts in the sky, because it's a very flat single tone across the sky because it's fog. But I can't, I can kind of print it as a cyanotype reasonably nicely, but I can't print it with a digital negative, and I'm not quite sure why that is.
I'm staring at this picture, which is like tractor tires marks going across a field.
I thought that was a multiple exposure at first.
It looks great. I don't know what you're complaining about.
Funnily enough, my wife was muttering at me, so she's hugely tolerant. But I was trying to print some. I was trying to print this last night, actually, with a different negative, different digital negative. And I was standing there looking at it, and she just looked at me and went, "What's wrong now?" Because, you know, it's got to be perfect or it's not right. But this print is okay. Although the actual physical print, the sun is... which is directly above the middle tractor lines, is just burnt out. It's too hot.
Blown out. Yeah.
But there, I mean, so when I when I spot metered it, it was like 11 stops range between the, because it was, the sun was just literally poking through the, but anyway, that's just me being a pain. But
being you, Andrew.
Exactly. But so I've tried a couple of different other digital negatives with this, but I'm getting artifacts in the sky. Not with, actually, interestingly, not with this version, but with the other versions I've tried. So whether I'm just pushing the image too far and the curve is just causing it to go silly. It looks fine printed as a negative, but when you print it through the negative, those things come out. But I'll move on, I think, and print something else.
So tell us about your calotype journey then. So, what's a calotype?
So, calotype. I heard about those through Wolfgang Mörsch, who's the chemicals guy, because I used to use his lith chemicals.
Yeah, me too.
And he does some fabulous prints that he pops up on Flickr. Yeah. You know, I don't know how. So presumably he runs this company, but he produces this inordinate amount of quality black and white or toned alternative printing. I don't know how he manages, but anyway. So he, I think some of his prints were color types, and he wrote a bit about them insofar as if you tone them with platinum or palladium, they're virtually indistinguishable from original platinum palladium prints, but they're considerably cheaper to make. So the emulsion is silver nitrate and ferrous oxalate. I can't remember what percentages those are. So you coat your paper with that. Another added advantage of that is actually you, once you've coated it and it's dried, you can leave that paper for several days and it's still printable. Obviously, you need to keep it in a light tight box. But so you then contact print on that. As you would normally. There are a number of steps. So you develop in sodium citrate and you can add a contrast booster to it, depending on what your negative is like. You then wash it, clear it with citric acid. Mm-hmm. Then when you wash it, then you have to tone it because otherwise it's kind of orange. And depending on how fresh your chemicals are and how dense the negative is, it's actually quite orange. So I don't think you ever keep a calotype as it is because it's also not very archival. So you can tone it at that point. So you can tone it with whatever precious metal you can afford to use, like platinum, palladium or gold. I have platinum and palladium chemicals from when I was trying to do platinum plated prints, so that's what I've been using. And you use a few drops to tone it rather than, you know, you might use several milliliters to coat a platinum palladium emulsion.
Right, gotcha.
So you're using a fractional of the amount, and those few drops in a liter of water you tone several prints with. So you then fix it and then wash it again. You can tone them with selenium, but selenium will bleach it. So if you're toning with selenium, you have to tone after you fix.
Yeah.
And there's some adjustment you have to do for loss of contrast and density.
People will know, and I haven't spoken about it for ages because Corey takes a mickey at me that you know, I've dabbled with salt printing, but I've never gone so far as to make digital negatives. I've just picked negatives that I thought will look good in the process and got on with it.
Yeah.
But I use I've tried selenium. Yes, selenium, and I thought that was a disaster. But I do regularly use gold. I bought some 1% solution gold solution or whatever it is from Wet Plate Supplies, and you mix that with borax, whatever that is, and make a sort of borax gold toner, and that shifts.
Yep.
That shifts the sometimes kind of reddy brown salt print. It shifts it into a more, what I find, pleasing tone, you know.
Yeah.
I find it can be a bit garish without it, and I think it also adds to the permanence of it as well.
I think gold is probably the preference for calotypes, because I think the platinum palladium are too cold, They're very black. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think the gold gives it a slightly warmer hue. But I don't have any. And I had the palladium, so I'm using that. And plus, I don't think I found anywhere that had gold toner in stock anywhere.
No, well, you can buy it in the buy the raw solution from Wet Plate and make add it to distilled water and other stuff, you know, to make it up yourself.
So yeah, so the calotype is interesting. It's a lot cheaper than platinum palladium, so you can iterate around it. But there are more steps which I think put people off, which is why it's not quite so popular.
Yeah, cyanotype is a real popular one, isn't it? Because it's so so easy, I guess, and accessible.
Yeah,
and then if you want to do salt printing or your calotypes, you have to go and buy some silver nitrate, which starts getting a bit more expensive, doesn't it?
Yeah, the cyanotype has been really interesting, especially the toning. I haven't tried lots of different things. I've tried coffee toning and tannic acid. And the coffee toning works really well, actually. I think what I might need to do is print them a bit darker and then with the bleaching... and the toning, you might end, because when you tone the cyan types, you have to bleach them with some washing powder to just to the point that they lose the blue tone. You end up losing some of the contrast.
Any washing powder?
And the highlights.
Any washing powder?
Initially, I just used some non-bio washing powder, but I got some. The chemical you're after is calcium carbonate, I think.
Mm-hmm. That's what you use in... I use that.
No, that's sodium. Yeah. Sodium carbonate.
Is it?
Oh, yeah,
is it?
Washing soda.
No, so I've got it wrong then. So it is washing soda. That's what you're after.
But if you buy if you buy the crystals, that you, I think we struggle. Yes. That's like, you need in the green bag. You need to add 2 or 3 times the amount for neat sodium carbonate, because it's... I think it's anhydrous or whatever the term is, or it's if you just weigh it out as per the Caffeinol cookbook, for example, you need to add more because it gives the alkali the right degree of alkalinity, but you need more if you're using the green stuff.
So this is for the Caffeinol or Caffeinol or whatever.
Yeah,
so if you're bleaching cyanotypes, you don't want it very strong because it works too quickly, and also it changes the tone to purple.
Right.
You need to bleach it for a little while until you lose the blue tone, but not so that you bleach the whole image. Mm-hmm. And then you need to wash it, but then obviously it keeps going for a little bit. If you have too much washing powder in it, it just goes.
Right. And then you're toning in coffee. Because I was looking at that image you've got of, I don't know what it is, but there's clearly some slats and a couple of vents and some...
Oh, that's in Ipswich. That's the Willis building.
Okay.
That's Pinhole?
Yep.
It is Pinhole, yeah.
It's designed by Norman Foster.
Yeah.
It's a very famous building. And I've tried to print that in a number of ways. The one at the top of my Instagram, that's a cyanotype, but from a digital negative. Because interestingly, I tried to print that. So further down in my Instagram feed, there is that negative as a cyanotype.
Yeah, that's what I was looking at.
Yeah, that's printed from the film, so there's no highlights, and you can't see the top of the building very well.
Right.
There's no definition there. So the one at the top of my feed is from a digital negative. So that way you can control the contrast and the density, so you can pull those things out. I don't think that one's toned, is it? Or is that one?
No, the cyanotype one, the blue one, which you've made from a digital negative, you're right. You've got much more definition in the sky. You can see the top of the building and you can see the sky.
Yeah.
Further down, you've got the coffee-toned version, which I really like, actually.
Oh, yes.
Where you've lost the top of the building, but I don't think that really matters, to be honest.
No. Yeah. So for the coffee toning, some people say use instant coffee, but we're snobs, we don't drink instant coffee. So I just do 2 strong shots of espresso diluted in a litre of water. And then you just leave it in that for 20 minutes, half an hour, after you've bleached it. The only thing I don't like about the coffee toning is that it does slightly stain the paper.
Yeah.
It's not as bad as some, but, you know, it doesn't really matter. If you're not printing with borders, then you don't know.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I like these pinhole pictures of the old car in the clouds almost. It kind of gives an eerie kind of...
I just walked past that in a local... in a local wood. I have no idea how long it's been there.
Right.
But that shot is that Ilford FP4. I think it was a 2.5 minute exposure or something.
Yeah.
And I've tried printing that a number of ways. I don't think I've created a digital negative for that one. Andrew, you said you use Pyrocat. So for some of my stuff, I use Morsch Phenol or Tannol, which are both tanning developers.
Yep.
Which, if you know, much like Pyrocat, which aids alternative printing. So it's much more of a UV blocker.
Yep.
So you develop it kind of normally, or maybe a little bit longer, depending on what process you're doing. And that enables you to print those much easier. If I've developed them with like for ID11, then that's much harder unless you overdevelop them.
Tannol, Mike, what's his name? Mike Hogan, was it? He launched that. There was a guy called Barry Thornton who you may have heard of. Barry Thornton's produced a couple of books, Edge of Darkness and something else. And he, if you read them, he takes you through his journey of finding. He's obsessive about finding, you know, the perfect kind of compensating developer. And he experiments with pretty much everything. And he developed his own tanning developer called Prescisol, PRESYCOSL or something. Anyway, Barry died. And this other guy who produced Tannol, who lives down near Heathrow Airport, he bought Barry's sort of details to his formula and took it over. But I don't think he's producing it now. And I noticed that Wolfgang was making something. He's either stocking Tannol or making his own version of it, which is another kind of tanning developer. Yes. And they all claim slightly different, you know, magic fairy dust, don't they, really?
Yes. Oh. Yeah. I try and not read into that too much. It works, so I use it.
Well, all these, if you're an alternative printer, I think people just point you towards tanning developers, don't they? And maybe using it slightly stronger, you know, in terms of instead of one, I mean, most of mine's 1+1, so one part A and one part plus B to 100 of water. But for alternative, most of them for like Pyrocat, they'll say 1+2 or 2+2, I think, don't they, to give it a bit more energy and presumably push the contrast a bit. I'm not really sure.
Yeah. And it depends on the curve of the film. And so I think the dilutions for FP4 and HP5 are quite different. Because of those characteristics. But
I've just seen that you've made... I was looking at one of your unadulterated pinhole pictures, and you've made you said you've made a Titan filter bodge.
Yes.
So what have you done to use filters with your Titan?
So I was trying to work it out. So initially I was just holding a 100 mil square filter in front of the pinhole and waving it around.
Yep.
So for a red filter for 30 seconds or something. But it didn't always work because if you didn't hold it close enough, you got some reflections or you might nudge the camera or stuff. So I was trying to work out how you do it, and then I gave up and just glued a screw-in filter on the front, so I can now screw. I don't know what diameter I use. 30 mil filters, yellow, orange, or red.
Tiny ones.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They don't appear to vignette. So obviously you need to worry about dust, particularly if you're shooting into the sun. Because obviously with the infinite depth of field of pinhole, you kind of see them if they're on there. So in my pinhole portfolio on my website, the second image is into the sun with a, is that a red filter or a yellow filter? I can't remember. Yellow filter, I've said.
Tire tracks again, yellow filter.
Yes, it's typical Suffolk winter countryside. It's just wet, low sun and fields. But you can kind of see some dust.
We don't know pointing that kind of thing out. I can't. So it's up to you.
Mate, it looks fine. It looks fine to me. I once stuck some filter gel inside a camera because Corey told me to, and
I was just about to make that. I was just about to recommend. Hey, you should just get
I tried that. It didn't work.
No, it doesn't work. You get all kinds of reflections and reflections and refractions.
I couldn't work out it was. I thought this is going to work. I stuck it inside, I shot four film holders worth, developed them, and everything was just blurry. And I'm thinking,
you should wait till you go on vacation, holiday, and then do a shoot all at the hospital.
That's what fortunately, I'd only gone as far as the bottom of the garden and shot the fence.
For your filter holder that you've glued on the front of your Harman, which I'm kind of shuddering with horror at the thought of it. I've done it to a Holger. You know, I've glued a step up ring on my Holger, so I can screw in filters.
Yeah,
but the thought of gluing stuff to one of Mike's lovely cones.
Well, yeah, I'm working on the assumption that you can change the cones.
Yeah, you could do. Yeah,
you can change the pinhole part, which comes in a in the nose bit.
Yeah. Oh, right. Yeah, I've got a spare one of those ready to put my own pinhole in. Yeah, You've stuck it to the
actual. Yes.
Oh.
Yeah.
Can you share a picture, perhaps, in the Facebook group or something?
Yeah, sure. I think there's a picture of it on my Twitter feed somewhere. Is there? But yes.
Okay.
I think.
No, share a picture in the group and anything of interest that we've talked about. Shove it into the group because people love to see all that stuff, you know.
Yeah. I mean, interesting. I did contact Mike, and he emailed me back, and he said he was thinking of doing some push fit filters on the inside.
Yes.
Which he was umming and ahhing whether he was going to do, but I've got fat fingers, so I don't think I'd ever it on without.
Well, the good thing about the filters being inside is that you won't get dust as you're taking the picture, but once you take the, you can always, as soon as you pull the film holder out, if you have a little can of air or a little dust brush, you can before you take another shot, just to make sure.
But you look at any of those pictures that I shot with the yellow filter inside, I've got all sorts of spots and reflections and just shit marks.
That's because you put a humongous 3x3 piece inside there. If you have a little tiny filter, like a 30 million, it's not
and does it need to be right in contact effectively with the inside of the pin? Or maybe
the closer you can get it to the pin hole, the better.
I think that's where I went wrong. Mine was probably a dirty, great big bit of.
The closer you can get the filter to the actual convergence of the pinhole.
Yeah. You didn't tell me that though, did you? See, you just let me go.
You wouldn't let you. You wouldn't let me tell you. You just—I don't know what I'm doing here.
You just learn stuff by yourself.
You just let me go off and shoot like six rolls of film with this stupid bloody filter in.
I said use a little piece of it, and he used. What do you use the zero image? So he cut the piece of plastic the entire inside of the body of the zero image and put it in there. Of course, you're going to get reflections. It's like 3x3 inches piece of plastic in there.
Yeah,
might as well put a light bulb in.
And then I shot a roll of color film in it as well, just for good measure. And forgot it was in there.
Yeah, well, that was kind of my thinking, was I would forget that I had whatever filter in it, and because I'm a bit simple. Yeah.
Excellent. So, yeah, well, yeah, share some photographs of your filter adapter.
Yeah, will do.
That'll be cool. That'll be good.
Well, maybe we'll have to have Andrew come back for a second part, because we still have some stuff
to
talk about.
Yeah, and you know, Corey gets excited if we go much over an hour. But there's a lot more to chat about. We've got some guests lined up for the next few shows, but maybe we can get you back on and talk some more, Andrew. If you'd like to come back on at some point,
more than happy to. Yeah. Yep, that's fine.
We'll make it a two-parter. Gosh,
I didn't.
I don't think we've ever done a two-parter, have we?
Oh, we got some. Well, if you do a two-parter, you'll have to. I've got guests lined up for the next three or four shows, Curry.
Well, you can do the second part after that. You don't have to do it immediately in sequence.
All right, I thought you meant
it's your show. You can do what you like.
Yeah,
that's right. That's what we're doing, Andrew.
Wing it.
You don't like it?
Yeah. We'll have you on for part two.
I didn't realize that there would be that much interesting stuff. But yeah, cool.
Yeah, definitely. All right. Well, everybody, have a great week, and we'll talk to you again in a few weeks.
Yeah, thanks, Andrew. Bye-bye.
Cheers. Thanks, gents.